Greetings, this is Alfred Wallace with the Decatur Herald and Review for September 21st, 2015. We will begin with the local news. First, homeowner injured when accosted by home invasion suspects. Decatur. A Decatur man was injured early Sunday as he fought with two men whom he said invaded his apartment looking for drugs. The 43-year-old victim said he was accosted at 2:27 a.m. by the men who pushed their way into his home in the 600 block of West Macon Street. A fight followed, during which the victim said he was punched in the head as he tried to force the suspects out. It was unclear from police reports exactly how the incident ended, but the victim, who said he knew the first name of one of his assailants, was not hurt seriously. Next, suspicious fire destroys vacant house. Decatur. A suspicious fire nearly destroyed a vacant Decatur house Sunday afternoon, but firefighters were able to knock down the flames before they could reach occupied homes close by. Neighbors had raised the alarm about 4 p.m. when they saw the empty one-and-a-half-story house at 956 North College Street was on fire. Battalion Chief Dan Klein said the flames began spreading up through the structure as crews arrived and deployed an aerial tower truck. The guys did a real good job, getting a rapid knockdown within 20 minutes and keeping the fire from getting into adjacent homes, Klein added. We had neighboring homes within 15 feet. Also this morning, man sustains life-threatening injuries from fight. Decatur. Police said a man is being held on aggravated battery charges after a fight early Sunday that inflicted life-threatening injuries on a Decatur man. Deputy Decatur Police Chief Cody Moore said officers had gone to the 1900 block of East North Street at 1:30 a.m. after being alerted to a man injured in a fight. Police found the victim with head trauma, and he later received what was described as advanced treatment at a regional hospital. Interviews with others involved in the fight and additional witnesses led to the arrest of the 36-year-old suspect, who lived in the neighborhood where the fight took place. Investigations were continuing Sunday night. Next, sewer study approval expected. Decatur. The Decatur City Council is set to vote on a consent order with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency involving the city's sewer system. The agenda item would direct the city to conduct a detailed study of its sewers and make repairs. Discussion of the plan has been ongoing for several years, as the federal EPA first contacted the city in 2012 to promptly eliminate overflows occurring in the sanitary and combined stormwater sanitary sewer systems. The order would require the city to provide a comprehensive review of its sewer collection system assets, including system management, maintenance, and capital improvement funding. In addition, it asks the city to have an analysis of areas identified as experiencing sewer backups during storms. Council is also set to vote on a contract with AECOM Technical Services to assist in the completion of the order. The expected cost is $456,620, which will come out of the Sanitary Sewer Fund, which is supported by the Sewer User Charge. The study is expected to take several months, while the sewer work will take several years to complete. I think we're pretty anxious to get things done, City Manager Tim Gleason said. Noncompliance with the EPA could result in thousands of dollars in fines. While the idea of sewer updates may not seem exciting, Gleason said it is vital to the long-term growth of the city. We're entering a rather unglamorous portion of Decatur history, but I think it's exciting, he said. It's a lot of the groundwork, setting the basic infrastructure that encourages businesses to invest in the community. In other business, the council is set to vote on the appointment of Chris Funk to fill the vacancy left when Julie Moore Wolf was appointed mayor. Funk, 35, is senior vice president and chief credit officer for Hickory Point Bank and Trust. He was one of four finalists interviewed for the position September 14th by five members of the council in a two-hour closed session. World War II. Unselfish service. 70 years ago, millions of Americans were returning home from their posts on ships, remote islands on the Pacific Ocean, and occupation duty in Europe. They had just celebrated the victory over Japan, which was sealed on the battleship USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay on September 2nd. That marked the end of nearly 4 years of U.S. combat in World War II, the most costly war in history. Almost every American served the war effort in some capacity, or had relatives, neighbors, and friends who were doing so. More than 1 million service members were killed or wounded. Looking back with pride at the accomplishments of the Greatest Generation, it is difficult to imagine the scope of grief, suffering, and anxiety they underwent. In recent years, more and more veterans and homefront workers have begun telling their stories, especially so younger people would understand the price they paid for freedom and prosperity. During the war, Connie Shaw stayed in her hometown, while she made important contributions along with many other area women. Shaw, who was 19 years old when America entered the war, lived in Longview Place, built in 1942, to house workers in war industries. She went to work at the Sangamon Ordnance Plant, just west of Iliopolis, where 15,000 workers, mostly women, produced artillery shells and bomb fuses. The concrete bunkers where the shells were stored in the massive 20,000-acre complex may still be seen among the farmland just north of Interstate 72. Shaw said that when she arrived each day at the plant via interurban train, the women would change into uniforms, consisting of men's trousers and underwear. In those days, women rarely wore slacks in public. "My first job was to put powder into the noses of shells," she recalled, adding that the substance was known as ammonium picrate. It looked like lemon jello powder. She was later transferred to the end of the line, where she placed fuses in the shells. The entire operation was underground. One day, after the women changed into their work clothes, they were descending the stairs to the level at which a guard searched them. The guard discovered that a woman in front of Shaw had a cigarette and a match hidden beneath her breasts. "Thank God she found that," Shaw said. "That was a very deadly thing to do." Shaw recalled two fatalities during her tenure at the plant. A man who was trying to loosen a shell from a crimper tapped it with a hammer. Apparently, he tapped too hard, or in the wrong place, because he and the shell went right up through the cement roof. A young woman who worked at a machine that made explosive pellets was cleaning a machine when it exploded. The work area was so dangerous that the machine was normally monitored from outside the room through a series of mirrors. Shaw was later hired at the Houdale Hershey Corporation plant on Decatur's north side, a top-secret operation that contributed to the production of the first atomic bombs. "I worked in the laboratory," Shaw said. "We didn't know what we were working on." She helped test metal tubes that were made in that plant. She later learned that they were used to separate different kinds of uranium. "There were a lot of engineers there from New York and Chicago," Shaw recalled. Her brothers, Stanley and Carol, served in uniform during the war. Shaw said she had ambivalent feelings about working in war industries because a lot of people died as a result of the conflict. "Then I reasoned that more people would have died if I hadn't done it," Shaw said. Supporting Patton's army. Bob Corey left Decatur High School during his senior year to enlist in the Army in March 1943, when he was 18. "I'd have been deferred until June," Corey said. "I couldn't wait to go." He was offered a choice of military branches, but rejected the Navy, despite a recruiter's word that he would always be within 5 miles of land. He understood that included the bottom of the ocean. After testing, he landed a spot in the Army Air Corps and was trained at the Republic Aviation Factory on Long Island to work on P-47 Thunderbolt fighter bombers. Corey was assigned to the 9th Air Force, 373rd Fighter Group, 411th Squadron, which supported General George Patton's Third Army as it advanced through Europe toward Germany. "We backed up Patton," Corey said. "Every time he moved, we moved with him." Corey and his fellow crew members landed at Normandy in early July 1944, about 1 month after the D-Day invasion. They worked long hours in every kind of weather, repairing damaged aircraft as well as performing inspections. Corey served in England, France, Belgium, Holland, and Germany. After the Germans surrendered in May 1945, Corey and most of the Army airmen returned to the States for leave, before heading to the Pacific for the expected invasion of Japan. While he was in Decatur, he heard the news that the war had ended. "A lot of people went to the transfer house to celebrate," he said. But Corey just went on his way to visit a girl he knew and celebrate quietly. "I had seen enough." Corey later served in the Army National Guard for 9 years and the Army Reserve for 30 years, retiring as a lieutenant colonel in 1984. He also served 21 years with the Decatur Fire Department and 12 years with the state's arson unit. On May 19, 1946, he married Norma Jean Dolly, whom he met while working at the Rogers Theater before the war. They were both in good health, residing on the city's east side near Eisenhower High School. Front row seat. Chaplain Art Watts had two brothers in the Navy. So when he turned 17, he figured it was time to drop out of school to do his part. Watts served 2.5 years as a gunner's mate aboard the USS Taylor, which participated in many battles in the Pacific and was among the ships to escort the USS Missouri into Tokyo Bay for the surrender ceremony. Admiral William Halsey, commander of the Third Fleet, selected the USS Taylor and two sister destroyers to form the escort, quote, "because of their valorous fight up the long road from the South Pacific to the very end." Watts had a close call with a Japanese kamikaze, suicide, pilot, while off the coast of Okinawa, which aimed for his ship, but was shot down. "We shot down a lot of planes," said Watts, 90, a resident of Evergreen Supportive Living, who could rattle off the names and locations of the numerous armaments that his ship deployed. "Our ship was loaded with more power than any other ship I saw." The destroyer's crew was called upon to bombard islands occupied by Japanese troops, sink enemy ships and submarines, and escort battleships and aircraft carriers. A shell that was aimed at the Taylor from an enemy shore gun almost hit its target, landing instead in its wake. "They had our range, but they didn't figure to lead the ship," Watts said. "They didn't know how fast we were going, almost 20 miles an hour." During his tour, none of the five ships in his squadron were lost. "We got strafed, but nobody was hurt," Watts said. "It ain't luck, it's just fate. We got them before they got us." After the Japanese emperor announced the nation's surrender, but before the official signing of the peace documents, the USS Taylor escorted the USS Missouri into Tokyo Bay. Watts' ship docked in Yokohama, while the USS Missouri dropped anchor out in the bay. "I went ashore," Watts said. "I went onto the dock and walked around. The people weren't hostile at all. They were lied to. They wanted it to be over." During the signing ceremony, USS Taylor was tied up alongside USS Missouri, Watts said. He saw sailors on top of the guns on the battleship, while he remained at his battle station with 40mm anti-aircraft guns. After the signing, the guys on the top of the guns were applauding, Watts said. During the signing, it was real quiet. After the signing, it was all over. Next, Event Aid's Rock Springs discovery. Decatur. 7-year-old Carrie Parrish would long for her computer, but, apart from that, she'd hop on a time machine tomorrow for a ride back to America's frontier past. She did her homework Sunday at the Prairie Celebration, hosted by the Macon County Conservation District at Rock Springs Conservation Area. The 2-day event featured costumed artisans and experts demonstrating everything from dyeing to gunsmithing, and even spear throwing, in a recreation of life on the western frontier in the 1800s and earlier. Claire, who has a 21st century home in Decatur, had just wandered past a working gunsmith to see a demonstration of how wood from an Osage orange tree could be used to dye clothes. After that, she was fired up and ready to head back to yesteryear. "I'd missed my computer the most, but yeah, I'd like to go, because it sounds really interesting, and I would learn how to shoot a gun," Claire said. "We've got another Annie Oakley," said artisan Lee Schaefer, who was busy displaying the dying art, while his wife, Carol, was all ready to show Claire how an 1865 spinning wheel turned raw wool into yarn. Everything was free to see and do, and Claire's grandmother, retired teacher Paula Veach, says it made for a great afternoon under warm, sunny skies. We come out to Rock Springs a lot because there's always so much here, she added. It's an educational, exciting, adventurous place. The Prairie Celebration, now in its 27th year, is one of Rock Springs' bigger events, and with face painting, wagon rides, and a food concession, is aimed at a family crowd. The celebration pulled in audiences of more than 300 both days. But what's surprising is how many people were discovering Rock Springs for the first time. One of the most important things that we're trying to accomplish is to help people find us, said Jeff Tisch, Program Services Manager. We have programs every weekend. We have a cool nature center. You can ride the bicycle trail, and we have ponds to fish in. Tisch also claims that children who do what their young ancestors did, go outdoors, will get more out of their 21st century lives. It's scientifically proven that children who spend more time outside get better grades, are on less medication, are less obese, and have a better attitude, he said. Next, Shelby County Public Defender gets down to work. Shelbyville. Clients of the Shelby County Public Defender's Office can discuss their cases with Public Defender Amanda Aide Harlow in person, on the phone, or by electronic media, including a Facebook account that she hopes will help more people get the information they need for their court appearances. I'm a huge fan of social media, Aide Harlow said. People don't always have access to a phone, or can't actually get to the courthouse, but if they are somewhere with Wi-Fi, they can use it to get in touch and get their questions answered. The Facebook page is one of the first additions Aide Harlow has made since taking the job as first full-time public defender in Shelby County in August. The Shelby County Board approved the hiring of a full-time attorney in hopes of reducing additional costs for conflict public defenders, appointed when the public defender was unable to represent the client due to a conflict of interest. Previously, there was a public defender only on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, Aide Harlow said. If there was a change in a client's plea or a negotiation, it often had to wait until right before the court date. Being full-time, here from 8 to 4 daily, I have a lot more time to meet with clients. Aide Harlow is working with clients to use Facebook and email consultations, including layering in restrictions of use to protect client-attorney privilege. She said that in many cases, social media is more private than one-on-one discussions in the courtroom. Sometimes, you end up having plea discussions with the state's attorney right in the courtroom with the judge in the room, she said. It's not an ideal way to have a discussion. If I've had a chance to meet with my client through email or Facebook, I can inform the state's attorney of where we stand, and they can be ready with paperwork or whatever is necessary to move the case forward. Shelby County Circuit Court Judge Alan Bennett said a full-time public defender was necessary because the legal system is changing. The public defender is as important as the state's attorney, the probation department, the circuit clerk's court office, and the judge, he said. The criminal justice system is expanding and changing so much there is a need to take this seriously. In addition to legal discussions, Aide Harlow said she plans to use social media to help clients find access to services and jobs they may need. If someone needs the public defender, they're in a situation where they probably need help in other areas too, she said. If I can act as a resource, maybe guide them to social services or a possible job, that helps their entire life. Next, Eastern Illinois University faculty concerns brought to trustees meeting. Charleston. The Eastern Illinois University Faculty Senate President brought up issues the Senate members have had with the university's lack of shared governance in the past and accused disproportionate spending to athletics at the Board of Trustees meeting on Friday. Jimmy Robertson raised questions about the Board of Trustees' interest in shared governance with student government, as well as Faculty Senate and Staff Senate. Robertson offered that the board does not share that interest, based on past board actions. Robertson referred to the board's approval of student fee increase to many areas, including athletics, which received the largest increase of $4.36. The Faculty Senate and Student Senate voted against a proposal to increase fees for athletics by $5.36. The proposal was changed slightly to better fit interests of the community. Both Senates were unable to vote on the changes. "Is this shared governance?" Robertson said. He said the transparency of how much money is going to certain areas is muddled, and the board should have more clearly designed shared governance in this decision. "If we can rescind an instructor's contract, can we not rescind a fee increase?" he said, mentioning the rescinding of faculty contracts early in the summer that were later renewed for the fall. Robertson said it was more difficult raising fees for courses. However, it is easier for athletics, too. "It has been easier to replace coaching staff than it has been to replace faculty," Robertson said. He also mentioned that athletes such as NFL quarterback alumnus Jimmy Garoppolo are not viable recruitment tools for the university. "There are young Garoppolos in a lot of our departments," Robertson said. "Young scholars who have great potential, and they deserve for their academics to be of the highest caliber, which becomes more difficult when we cut one or more positions." Tom Michael, athletics director, said his department is trying, like any unit on campus, to be fiscally responsible. "Our population hasn't changed in 10 or 12 years since enrollment has declined," Michael said. "We still have the same number of sports and the same number of student athletes." He said the department was working on maintaining all of those sports with less money each year. "Each sport budget is being pulled back," he said. "It's been a pretty big impact." Michael said they are trying to work on cutting operational budgets to fit university's budget. The board did not comment or question Robertson's statements. The board also approved the university to offer a new medical services degree program in biochemistry and biotechnology. Blair Lord, provost and academic affairs vice president, said biotechnology and biochemistry are growing in demand, and interest among students is as well. The program is expected to enroll 10 majors in the first year, then 25 once the program is fully implemented. The program must now be approved by the Illinois Board of Higher Education, which Lord said they are currently reviewing. Also, Roger Cratchville, board member, announced that the gift total to the university has exceeded $10 million again for the fifth time. The board also approved the naming of Room 1151 in Claim Hall, in honor of Deborah Woodley, for her financial support of the university. Next, man batters woman holding toddler. Decatur. Jamie M. Taylor, 29, of Decatur, has been charged with a felony count of aggravated battery for allegedly repeatedly punching a woman in the head on a public street while she was holding a child younger than two, after dragging her out of a vehicle. Taylor, who was booked into the Macon County Jail shortly after the incident, was released after posting $5,000 cash bail. He is due in court October 6th for his arraignment. A condition of his release is to have no contact with the victim or go to her residence. The incident took place early the morning of Friday, September 4th. Taylor, who was listed in a court document as 6 feet tall, weighing 175 pounds, was in a short-term relationship with the victim. He drove to her workplace, apparently to give her a ride home. Taylor then drove to an East Side residence to pick up the woman's son. An argument between Taylor and the woman took place in the vehicle. Jamie pulled the vehicle over at 22nd Street and Hendricks Street and told the victim to exit the vehicle, which she refused, said an affidavit by Decatur Patrol Officer Ryan Strebing. Taylor then grabbed the woman and dragged her out of the vehicle. Once outside of the vehicle, Jamie began striking the victim with both of his closed fists in the head area, Strebing wrote. Taylor then threw some of her possessions from the vehicle. victim leaned into the vehicle to remove her son, who was strapped into a child safety seat. While she had the toddler in her arms, she made a comment to him about what he had done, using profane language. Jamie again went after the victim and stood over her, striking her with both hands in the head area while she had the toddler in her arms, the court document said. Taylor continued the assault until two bystanders screamed at him to stop. Taylor argued with the bystanders, then got in the vehicle and drove away. When police arrived, the victim, quote, was extremely emotional and crying. Officers observed that she had been bleeding from both lips and her nose. She had an approximately baseball-sized welt on the left side of her face near her eye. Taylor, located at a relative's residence, told police he was driving her home from her workplace when he stopped because he and the woman, quote, were not getting along. Jamie advised that they had a verbal argument but did not get physical, the police statement said. Next, exchange student revels in culture of Hungary. Siegel. Exchange student Bridget Dietz of Siegel spent a year amid the old world architecture and expressive local language of Hungary. The 18-year-old, who was the daughter of Jim and Julie Dietz, lived with a host family of Debrecen in eastern Hungary. Debrecen is home to more than 200,000 people and is the second largest city there after the capital, Budapest. She said her host city was about 2.5 hours from Budapest by train. I measure things in train rides now, Dietz said. There, public transportation in Hungary is very good. A lot of foreign tourists are drawn to Budapest because of its scenery on the Danube River and the good exchange rate for Hungarian currency, the forint, Dietz said. The capital city has an interesting combination of old architecture and modern urban lifestyles, she added. Dietz said she found the site of old world architecture throughout Budapest, Debrecen, and other areas of this country in Eastern Europe to be comforting. No matter where you go, you feel at home and at ease, Dietz said. It's nice to walk around a country and feel the history of that country. Dietz said her German language studies at the University Laboratory High School in Urbana helped her get to know people in Hungary, where German is the third most spoken language. However, Dietz said many Hungarians speak English. While in Hungary, Dietz was determined to learn the local language. Dietz said Hungarian is mostly spoken in its country of origin, but learning this language is a great way for someone to enrich their vocabulary and thought processes. Dietz, a freshman community health education major at Illinois State University, said spending a year in a foreign country and learning a new language has made her a more vibrant individual. It's made me overall a more confident person, Dietz said. We will now take a short break and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review in just a second. Please stay tuned.